during the games where they were waiting for moves, quite often they were playing poorly. So the increase in the quality of the games was coming from the cheating moves, but for the rest of the time, they were just so distracted because they're just waiting, like, when's the move going to come? And also feeling a bit guilty. Most strong players have always assumed that you only need one or two moves to make a huge difference. You'll get 100 ELO points if you just get two suggestions per
game.
That's
what he lost that game. When he was a cheater.
Yeah. Fortunately, the opponent didn't accuse him because that would have been a double whammy as well. I think the opponent was like, yeah, you can't be cheating in this one. But,
maybe you can even include, I'm going to give you the moves, but I'm going to give it to you at the bathroom, for example.
Mm.
So,
but that
you're adding another layer.
That has an element where there's a tell.
But everybody goes to the bathroom. Like, you wouldn't know who's going off more. Yeah. What's up, everybody? Here in St. Louis with a very special guest for... you're here for one of the conferences organized by the St. Louis Chess Club, the Education Conference. Grandmaster David Smurden, first time meeting in person. It's great to have you here in St. Louis. Welcome to the pod, and tell us a bit about yourself for our audience to understand what you do in general. You're not much of an active player nowadays. We already kind of talked about this off air, but tell us about what you do and why you're here.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me. First time in St. Louis. So I'm here for the St. Louis Chess Conference, which is sort of a mixture of academic researchers who do something related to chess, and then practitioners, so people working in FIDE and other organizations. But yeah, you're right. I'm not a very active player. I kind of semi-retired in 2016, that Olympiad in Baku. And from there, I decided to go 100% into an academic career. So I'm an assistant professor of economics at the University of Queensland. And most of my research is about development economics. So things that are affecting people in developing countries most of the time, some kind of, you know, more serious topics, more applied topics. But I've also carved out a little bit of a niche of my time, which is as a, I guess, a chess economist, if that's a term, where I do research that I hope helps the chess world in some way, bring some evidence to a lot of these debates.
And maybe we can start also with the story about how you met Fabiano.
Yeah.
You guys met quite a while ago, yeah?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Was it 2007 we've decided?
That's when we decided, yeah. That was 2007. We played a game in the Dragon. I think you were like a main Dragon player, right?
Yeah, yeah. And for that tournament, I prepared it especially for you because, you know, you play these first Saturday tournaments hoping to get a norm. So everyone playing in the tournament's reasonably talented, but just the day before it started, I think the organizer said, oh, by the way, there is this wonder kid who's playing. He's probably going to get the norm. Everybody better try to catch up to him. So I saw that I was black against you, and I prepared this sort of special Dragon line.
It worked out, yeah? Like, I don't think I got anything, and then we made a draw.
Yeah, you found pretty much all the best moves that my very old computer had said that you should find, and then offered a draw, and I knew that it was just equal, and I was super scared of you. Rightly so, it turns out.
Also, you know what? The Dragon, like, always scared me, so I was also... I remember being kind of scared, also because you were in prep, and then we spoke a bit after the game. I don't remember exactly what our conversation was about, but probably related to the game.
Yeah.
That's, I played a lot of those first Saturday tournaments. Those were some good memories.
Yeah, so the story that kind of also illustrates how our paths diverged was, so after the game, we chatted about the game a bit. I think your father was there as well. Yeah. And I sort of naively said, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And you looked at me like I'd asked the stupidest question in the world, and you said, chess player. And that had just never occurred to me. You know, as an Australian, it's just not a career option at all. And, you know, it was a stupid question, as it turns out, obviously. But that's, yeah, in my life, it was never anything more than a hobby. It was always, you know, you're going to go off and do something else. And even our very top players now have the same problem. Like, they could be professionals, but, you know, they're getting corporate offers, they're going off to some sort of other job, and you can't really be a professional in Australia. So I always remember that comment, though, like, chess player, of course. And I was like, oh.
I think maybe I also had the naive optimism of a kid, like, everything's going to work out, which, of course...
Which it did.
It did, yeah, but you never know.
Yeah.
Is it just because in Australia it's so difficult to travel to tournaments, just so far away from most of, like, the chess action in the world? Is that why players struggle to continue professionally?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you were saying that Singapore is kind of going to be your furthest trip, and that's still another 7 hours before you get to Australia. So
yeah, it's a long trip.
We had that one professional for a long time, Ian Rogers, you might remember, who was sort of up near the top for a while, for quite a while actually. But he based himself in Amsterdam for a lot of his travel, and a lot of young Australians actually have spent time in this one little apartment in Amsterdam because it's that they offer it very sort of freely. And
I think I've been to that apartment
probably
in like the in 2020, like right after Kansas was canceled halfway, and then I had to go through Rotterdam, I think, to like try to get back to the United States, and then I had a few hours in Amsterdam, and Dirk-Jan ten Guzendam, he said, well, you can stay in my place. And I think it was like shared between him and Ian Rogers, if I'm...
It could be.
I think so.
Yeah.
And so I just like slept there for like 3 hours before my flight.
Right. Okay.
But Ian wasn't there. But yeah, it seemed like some sort of like shared chess home in some ways.
Yeah. I think there are more keys to that apartment than any other sort of shared key. Yeah. I remember once I was staying there and I think Jen Shahidi just sort of showed up as well. And so she was staying there for a couple of nights. So yeah, it's probably the same one. But he was sort of our, you know, our leading chess player for a while. But sort of since then, we, you know, he led the way for a lot of other young grandmasters. But as a professional pursuit, it's still not there.
Mm-hmm. How did you gravitate towards economics?
It's something. So economics as a field is not something I'm interested in, as in the economy. But after some time, I've always been kind of interested in how I can improve the lives of people in developing countries. That's always been some sort of motivation. And at some point, I realized that economics was actually a pretty good tool for doing this. The whole concept of development economics never occurred to me. I thought it was all about, you know, numbers and finance and things like this. But essentially, development economics is a little bit like chess. It's really just getting inside the minds of other people, understanding what they want to do, how they're executing it, and as opposed to exploiting it, trying to find a way to improve it for them. That's all it is, basically. So it's sort of half psychology, but it's using data and evidence to try to, you know, make policies that make things better. And the skills involved actually aren't that different from saying do opening research. So say you want to go novelty hunting, you go through games, you go through an engine, you use a little bit of intuition, you gather data, you test it. So I used to love doing that stuff with the dragon, for instance, and now I've just put it into a different domain.
That must have been a pretty difficult moment for you to decide to quit chess, because not only now I'm finding out that you drew Fabiano as well, but you drew Magnus Carlsen also in that final tournament of yours, or at least final as a professional, if you might, the Olympiad. You were winning in that game.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember vividly that you were kind of the talk of town because you drew Magnus, but from a position of strength.
Yeah, so the Australian team was obviously very, you know, happy that I drew, and I got lots of messages. But you know, the reality, as the two of you can appreciate, is that I missed an opportunity, not that I should be rewarded for it. Yeah. And the next day, Ivan Sokolov, who never sort of beats around the bush, of course, he came up to me during the next game, put his arm around my shoulder, and he said in his thick accent, he said, you know, you drew Magnus, you're the hero for today. If you had a one, you would have been the hero for a lifetime. Just think about that. And then he walked off. And I was like, oh man, he's right. I should quit chess. You know? No, but I mean, I was always like, I got some good results. I drew with Aronian also at one of the Olympiads. I played Dominguez in the World Cup, where I played the dragon, and the same like our game. Like, I just prepared theory to a draw. Mm-hmm. But, and so we had five draws in a row. And then in the sixth game, it just sort of occurred to him, oh, I can just play anything against this guy and I'm a better player, which he did, and he won. And that was the end of my World Cup.
Do you remember which World Cup that was?
2009, I think.
Okay, yeah. That's what I thought, because I played one year after.
You played after?
Yeah, I played him after. I played him in the second round.
Ah, right. Yeah. And you beat him in the second round.
Yeah, the
funny thing is that after our game, the final one, we went for a drink together while we were analysing, and he had his seconds there. Mm-hmm. And I had my girlfriend at the time who didn't know how to play chess. And we sort of looked at our two teams and sort of realized, you know, different levels of professionalism. And then I said to him, oh, so who are you playing in the next round? And he said, didn't you check before the tournament who you're playing? And I said, well, no, I just stopped at you, basically. And he looked at me again the same way you looked at me when I asked you what you wanted to do when you grew up. Like, you know, how can you not even check if you're a chess player? And it sort of also highlighted, there's like a, you know, there's grandmaster, but there's class distinctions, and I'm never really going to reach that top level.
Obviously, you're here because you did a lot of research combining chess players and economics. How do you pitch those type of topics to, you know, your supervisors, I guess?
To the non-chess playing
group?
Right,
to the academia. How do you pitch that?
Yeah, I remember the first time I approached my boss and said, I want some money to buy a chess base.
Yes.
And he looked at me like, come on, Dave. Like, no way. Yes. And I was like, look, if I can publish a paper.
It's like $500, by the way.
To get the full package. Yeah. And if you want to get like other sort of chess related stuff, and you know, I'm being flown to this conference on an economist budget, right? So to be able to convince them that presenting at a chess conference is worthwhile was a tough sell at first. But so I said, yeah, if I publish a paper in, you know, we have also tiers of journals, like that you publish in scientific journals. If I can publish in the top one about chess, would that sort of, you know, signify that this is real research? Mm-hmm. And so when that happened, he said, okay, I kind of understand now. And the key, I think, is to make sure that whatever I'm researching is generalizable beyond a chess playing audience. Otherwise, there's no point. So for instance, I did a paper about wearing face masks and how that affects the quality of play. And at the time, face masks was a super big policy topic, sure. You know, and the question about schools, what do we do with kids in schools when they're doing exams? Should we give them exceptions? Like, this is a much wider topic. And the same for things around gender. You know, why don't we have enough girls graduating from STEM subjects? Economists care about that because if there's something societal that's affecting it, our labor market is not efficient, which means our economy is not efficient, which means we're all worse off. Right. So that's how I pitch it. Mm. Yeah.
If you have a subject in chess and you make a conclusion there, can you extrapolate to another field? Like to if we're talking about gender, can you say you make a conclusion in chess playing world?
Mm.
Does that help you understand why maybe there are not women, so many women in STEM?
Yeah, sometimes yes, and sometimes no. So the key is to try to make that link as much as possible. And if you can't make that link, then you say, okay, well, this is just one more piece of evidence on a pile now that we have. So for instance, with STEM, a big debate is how much do gender stereotypes and role models matter? Like, if you only see men getting Nobel Prizes, does that trickle all the way down to the girl who's choosing whether to do high school physics or not? That sort of stuff. And so there's some evidence from the chess world that role models matter. Some evidence from Kenya and Uganda using the Queen of Katwe movie. So there's a really nice sort of experiment that they do there. And that's not going to tell us how to get more girls into physics and chemistry, but it's suggestive evidence. We add that to the pile. They've done some other ones around other topics that aren't STEM as well, but where there's a big sort of gender gap. And we keep adding those together, and then at some point you start running experiments that have picked up things that have worked in one field into another field. And if they work there as well, then you say, okay, now we've got a lot of evidence. Let's roll this out. That's kind of the idea.
This sort of makes me think about Judith's recent comment about not needing women's titles. Just because you're setting up a low ceiling for female players. Did you do any research in that regard? Do you think we should abolish female titles?
I've done a little bit around this topic in general, so around gender, and I'm doing more at the moment. That specific question,
a tricky one.
Touching
it
is tricky,
one.
Yeah. Jude and I have had a conversation about this as well. It's something that she feels very strongly about, but, and you know, her opinion should be given a lot of weight. But a lot of her opinion is coming from her lived experience. Her lived experience is very valuable because she made it to top 10 in the world, but it's also, you know, strictly speaking, very limited number of data points. Mm. That's not to say that she's not right. It's to say that it's not enough evidence for us to overhaul things. So at the Olympiad, they actually had a conference there that she organized where I spoke about a bunch of topics, and gender was one of them. And I said, look, for all these things, I'm not going to come in and say yes or no. I'm going to say, let's run the experiment. And people are often, you know, a bit put off by the idea of running experiments, but they're not that difficult to do. So you can imagine a setting where you're already running a chess in schools program and say it's a big one, you've got like 200 kids, maybe you've got 100 girls, for example, you divide them up 50 and 50, you make sure that they're pretty even to begin with, and then for 6 months you run the program where these girls get awards every time they hit the same metrics as boys, mm-hmm. and the others get awards when they hit these girls only titles. And then you track them a year later, 2 years later, and you see if their motivation's changed and you see if their performance has changed. So that's a pretty simplified view, but you get the idea, right? Like, that's how we would run this sort of stuff to gather some evidence.
Have you guys done any of that research? Or
I proposed it in Budapest. The problem is it needs some brave people. So it needs like a setting that's willing to take it on, some brave people who are willing to say, yeah, let's do it. But I think if you really believe in something like this, then being prepared to push forward with evidence gathering is the way to go.
Is there an age for the girls that you would start this experiment? Like, let's say 14 years of age or like 12 years of age. Like, when would you start this
experiment? I would probably try to keep it pretty broad at the moment, because we don't have much evidence leading into it to motivate it. Yeah. We don't know for sure that, yeah, nothing ever happens before the age of 10, so start from 10. So in my group of 50, I would have different ages, but I would make sure that the age distribution was the same in the other group of 50. And then I would check, because it might be that, well, actually there's no effect unless you go to girls who are, whatever, below the age of 14, then it works, but above the age of 14, it's too late. Therefore, we should do it, but we should do it early. So that would be the idea.
Mm-hmm. But if you have, like, let's say you determine that it would be beneficial to have non-gendered tournaments all around, mm. but you also have an infrastructure where a lot of people are reliant, because it's their career, on having gender tournaments. Mm. How would you strike a balance between those two things? Or is that just outside of the general recommendation? Like, is that outside of the scope of your research?
So there's gathering evidence to get suggestions, and then there's getting those suggestions put into policy, and that second step is always tricky. Mm-hmm. A lot of researchers stop at the first step, but for something particularly that I'm passionate about, I would sort of try to make sure that I could see it through to actually making change. For something like this, if you find the evidence amongst, say, girls from the age of whatever it is, 10 to 18, it's actually having a big effect, mm-hmm. that doesn't actually necessarily say that we should scrap gendered tournaments at the professional level. It just might be that for those who are running chess in schools programs and currently divide them up and currently have girls-only tournaments, that should probably stop. Mm-hmm. So you'd basically start at the application where you found evidence, and you wouldn't touch anything about the US champs. You wouldn't touch anything about Norway chess at the moment. You'd basically see how this goes when it's rolled out, and then maybe gradually that leads to change. Maybe it never does. Maybe at the adult elite level, you always have that segregation. I don't know. Yeah, because you're right. At the moment, the infrastructure is so strong, and a majority of women players don't want it to change. I think so long as you've got a majority of women players who aren't driving this, I don't think anything's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, because the question is, foundationally, I guess, you can take a female player and you put her on the trajectory of reaching 2750, but then at some point, she goes on to play women's tournaments, which have the same price ones as the men tournaments or the open tournaments. And then will her ceiling drop at that point when she starts competing only against 2550s or like 2600s max?
Yeah, it comes. Yeah,
there is a stage where it.
You're right.
Of, you know.
Yeah.
Challenges these two concepts challenge each other, I guess.
Yeah, but there's sort of this broader question that people say, why don't we have women in the top 10 anymore? Why isn't there another Judith? Why do we only have one woman in the top 100? I don't think that the gender segregated tournaments would explain much of this at the moment. So there's, you know, it's a very complex issue. There's a multitude of factors. There are very smart people who are working on this. I think it could have some effects, particularly in terms of the participation, the fact that we don't have as many girls, particularly at the age of 17. There's a huge drop-off.
At 17, okay.
Yeah, so boys also drop off, but girls drop off much more at a higher rate, and that's a bit surprising.
That's right before college, more or less.
Yeah, and it's right about the time that you go from being in your girls' team at school and girls' tournaments to having to make the effort to go to an open adult club where you might be the only woman in the room. So I'd imagine that there's something around that sort of change that's affecting the participation quite a lot. But just saying we're going to scrap women's titles, I don't think that's going to immediately, or even in the next 5-10 years, see a woman, another woman, get into the top 100. I don't think that's a big part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. No, I mean, you see it like in US chess, definitely, that like in the US Championship, a lot of the women who are very strong, they tend to focus more on their academic career, while the guys mostly focus on chess, or it's more mixed, at least.
Okay.
So there's it could also be U.S. culture.
Yeah.
But there's definitely that like very visible difference in approach to professional chess.
Yeah. I would say from U.S. players, even the guys mostly gravitate towards like going into college. Like I know because as a recruiter for my university, I barely can get any American players. Like at that point, at 18 years of age, if they're grandmasters, they can already go to Ivy League schools, and they usually choose to do that rather than continue focusing on chess. And if they do focus on chess, they sometimes combine that with like a university degree as well.
Yeah. I think it's like, so as a good economist, we care about inefficiencies more than anything else, not about what we think people should do, but just are things efficient or not. So if there's a, you know, an American teenager who's quite good at chess,
yes,
but ends up going to college and becoming a whatever, it could be that that was just the best decision for him.
Yes.
And if that's the best decision for him, there's no reason for us to get in and change things. You know, it'd be good for the chess world, but not necessarily for him.
For sure. Yeah. But on the, they go to Ivy League schools and they become extremely successful in other fields.
But if we have a 17-year-old girl who would love to be a professional chess player, that's what she wants to do, but there's something else, like some societal, cultural, whatever it is, which means that she's not doing it. Not because she doesn't want to, but because of the situation, that's inefficient. Because she should be a chess player, she wants to be a chess player, something's stopping her. So that's where we come in and say, okay, can we find out what it is, and then how do we change things?
Very cool. You're going to present at the conference a topic about cheating. Cheating in chess, that's obviously very hot right now. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I know you've spoken about it a lot on the pod, which
everybody's talking about. It.
Everybody's talking about it. But that's kind of funny because do you remember the time when you couldn't really talk about it? Or not you couldn't talk about it, but you couldn't accuse someone. That was the worst thing to do. Do you remember there was like, I think it was maybe Mamed Yarov who was sort of the first. He accused Dennis someone. Was it Dennis someone at Aeroflot? I think it was like quite some years ago now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that was a big deal because everyone was like, oh, you can't just accuse without evidence.
Right.
And now there's been a cultural shift. It's a free-for-all. Well, at least for some people.
For online chess especially, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe there's like also some sort of distinction, like FIDE doesn't get involved in online chess. Chess.com or other websites don't get involved in over-the-board chess.
Mm.
And maybe FIDE doesn't see it as their place to sanction or to discipline people who have accused without evidence, I guess. I mean, it's hard to say what evidence really is in this case.
Yeah.
Besides hard evidence, but yeah, it looks like these kind of major players are staying in their own yard and not mixing too much.
Yeah.
There was also a case, a coach who accused a top women's player and got over the board event a few years ago and got banned by FIDE from coaching, from attending tournaments, and so on.
Ah, right.
For
okay.
maybe 6 months or so. So there are definitely some cases of sanctions.
He accused Bibisara, right?
I think it was Asabaya. Yeah. Bibisara.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Because I think, was it Sandu who was accused a long time ago as well?
Players
in
tournaments.
And there was that letter, and it was a whole sort of thing. So
that was a bit unfortunate because, I mean, it definitely impacted her psychologically in the tournament. Whenever you're facing this type of accusations, and it's so difficult to play chess, right?
Yeah. And there were sanctions against some of the players, I think.
Some of the players, or
maybe very few, but definitely there were some sanctions taken.
I don't think anybody got suspended.
Did
they?
Yes. One I'm sure of got either a 3-month or 6-month ban.
Really? Okay.
I think I remember that for the lead author of the letter or something. So
I guess it was like maybe a lot of players wrote in and maybe they just decided they can't ban everyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, now it's more or less a free-for-all, as you said. Everyone is throwing something at someone else.
Name of your paper is Cheating and Suspicion in Chess, Insights from a Control Tournament Experiment.
Yep.
Which one is that? What did you do?
So I've got a few projects related to cheating. One with chess.com, looking at sort of behavioral ways on their platform to discourage people. So there's obviously like there's the stats side of things, and they got a lot of people working on that, very smart people. But as a sort of behavioral economist, I'm also interested in ways that discourage kids from sort of going down that road. You know, there are always going to be some people who, you know, a cheater's going to cheat. They're, no matter what you do, this person's going to be a cheater. But for a large amount of people, their chess path will actually affect whether or not they ever start it, or once they start it, how they react to it. And so I'm sort of interested in if there are ways to try to discourage that, change the norms around it. But the one I'm going to present about, I think it's kind of cool. I ran an experiment. I've been saying experiment a lot, but I ran a real chess tournament. I put on a real chess tournament, but I called it the Cheating Challenge. I had special rules, and so it was an 8-player double round robin. They didn't know who the other players were. And I said to them, before the round, you may get a message from me that says you have been designated a cheater for this game. So you're going to be a cheater. And during the game, I'm going to send you engine moves at moments that I think are critical. So far, so good. You get to be a cheater. Sounds great. It's one-way communication, so it's a little bit like the fella case at the Olympiad. Yes. So you don't know when it's coming, but at some point you know you might get a signal. But the twist is that at the end of the tournament, you can lodge accusations against any of your opponents in any rounds. And it's costly to do it. It costs you a point to lodge it. But if you're successful, you get the point back, plus you get an extra point. So you either lose a point if you're wrong, or you get plus one if you're right. And if someone accuses you of cheating and they're right, you lose 1.5 points. So you want to cheat, but you don't want to get caught as well. So I'm trying to like emulate a real sort of situation as close as I can.
Was this an online tournament or OTB?
It was online, but it was controlled online. So they couldn't cheat.
They couldn't see each other. They didn't know who they're playing against each other. What were the ratings of the players?
Lowest was 1600 ELO. Highest was 2350, was an IM. There was another who became an IM sort of shortly after the tournament. So there were sort of two around IM string. There was a FM, a CM, down to 1600. Youngest 17, oldest 51, I think.
If you were if you were asked to cheat, were you required to cheat or could you abstain?
If your opponent accused you of cheating, even if you hadn't played any of the moves I sent you, you would still lose the points because you'd been designated a cheater. So it's imagine that you've got like a little device on you, but you decide I'm not going to listen to it, or you brought it into the room. So sorry.
Okay. And, How did you guys send the moves?
Because it was online, I sent it.
Just like text?
Just text, yeah. And if they communicated back, I said, sorry, it's only one-way communication. Because, I mean, I think we can sort of all agree here that, you know, online cheating is a larger problem numerically, but there are people working on that side of things, and there's always a point that they won't be able to cross, but okay, that's another problem. But OTB cheating is something that I'm quite interested in because we have no idea of the scope of it. We have no idea how people's behavior and play changes when they're getting hints, so I was interested in that as well, like how your play changes when you're a cheater, but also if you suspect your opponent of cheating, how it affects your play, and then most importantly, how good are we at accusing people of cheating? I wanted to know that.
So what was the result? Was there a good strategy? Were there people who were able to hide their cheating from their opponents, or was everyone more or less clear?
So in terms of the accusation success rate, it was 69% correct. So 50% would be chance. Mm-hmm. So it's better than chance, but not a whole lot better than chance. So then unpacking that a bit further, I also varied the amount of suggestions that I gave kind of like randomly, we say, because I wanted to see how that changes. If I give you just one move, if I give you two moves. So most people I gave between 2 and 10 moves. Mm-hmm. Some I gave like 20 moves. And I wanted to see whether your detection abilities changed. And so in addition to you accusing, I also said, okay, you're not going to lose money for this. Just tell me, what do you think is the probability that your opponent's cheating, and how confident are you that they're cheating? So I gathered all this sort of data. Whether I sent one move or 20 moves didn't affect your suspicions at all. Mm. The suspicions didn't vary with the number of moves, which is crazy.
Did people tend to, if you were to give 20 suggestions, would they tend to listen to all 20, or would they moderate it in some way?
usually people played about 90% of the suggestions. Yeah. And if I'm giving a lot of them, most of the time they were taking, still 90%, but that's like a lot of moves basically. Yeah. But I guess like one thing that was really surprising to me, which I didn't expect, is that, so I did all these things to predict what's the likelihood that you will accuse your opponent. What increases your suspicion the most? And I thought it would be if the opponent plays fewer blunders, you suspect them more. Or if the opponent's center pawn loss is lower, you suspect them more. Like things like that. Mm-hmm. Or if the opponent is lower rated but playing better. You know, all these sort of combinations. None of those things predicted it. The number one thing that predicted whether you accuse is if you made more blunders in the game.
Okay, interesting.
So it's very subjective in a sense.
That's what I take from this, yeah.
Or could it be that if you play against someone who is cheating, that increases your likelihood of making blunders?
It could, because particularly if it's in your head and if you're distracted. Mm-hmm. So the next thing to do, which I was going to do this afternoon, which I haven't done yet, is obviously I can see the moves when I first sent the first cheating suggestion. So I can look at the rate of blunders that you do before that point, which shouldn't be affected, and hopefully then I'll be able to tell. But my strong suspicion from what I'll find is that it is kind of an internal way of putting the blame somewhere else for your own bad play. Mm-hmm. So kind of like a projection bias. I'm playing badly. I don't want to, you know, cognitive dissonance. I don't want to accept that it's my fault. So I know there's a chance my opponent's cheating. I subconsciously maybe increase my suspicion. And I think that's probably something that happens outside this experiment as well.
So yeah, that's what I was sort of going to lean into, because there was this idea that strong players, and especially the strongest players, have a sort of sense of... I mean, I kind of share this feeling a little bit, but of course I admit I'm probably biased, but definitely there is a large feeling that, that very strong players can feel if their opponent's cheating. Do you think that this is complete bogus for the most part?
Well, what I think doesn't matter. It's what the evidence says. And fortunately... I ran a second experiment. So this is a really nice way for me to segue into it. But I don't think that it's bogus. And first of all, when I've listened to this pod in particular, what I really appreciate about you and a few other strong players like you is that you kind of don't have this halo effect where I'm super good in one domain, therefore I must be good in lots of other domains. You kind of know when your experience could matter for a domain, and also you can recognize when it probably doesn't. So I really, yeah. So that's a good thing. Not all your peers are like that, as you probably know, but we're all human, so that makes sense. Anyway, so the second reason that I ran this experiment was I now have 112 games where I know for certain whether one player was cheating or not and how much they cheated. Nobody's got a data set like that. So when, you know, Ken Regan runs his algorithm, or when chess.com runs its stuff, they have incredible stats. Both of them have incredible stats. I've seen their analysis. But they don't have a great training data set. A lot of the time they're using things like the Feller games or something like that. But here we have it. So what I did next, and you may remember, you might have seen this online, I posted it. I posted it for the chess world.
I took the test.
Did you take the test?
I took the test. And my coach at the time, it was right around summer of last year, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so we were at a tournament and we both took the test.
Cool.
Well, we kind of collaborated, so it wasn't like we took it separately.
Yeah. You cheated in my test. I'm going to have to take you out of the data now. I'll just, for the viewers, I'll explain. So what you do when you sign up for this thing is you're given seven of these games that were in the tournament. So you see the game. It's on the little chess.com screen. You can play through it. You see the evaluation after each move. You see the move times. You can take it to the analysis board if you want. And then we say, what do you think the chances are that Black was cheating? Do you think Black was a cheater or not? So you're given seven of these. And 10,000 people took this survey around the world. So I got people from a chess.com rating of 100 to, I don't know if Magnus took it or not, so you'd probably be my strongest player. But
I'm not sure if I like entered my rating accurately.
Right.
but hopefully I did.
There were two players who entered 2,800 as their rating. One of them I know was 2,800 at the time. And I know who it was, so it wasn't you. I don't know what you entered, so I don't know whether the other one was just somebody.
I just can't remember.
But we sort of whittled down the sample to those who provided either their FIDE ID or their LeeChess user or their chess.com user. So we can break it down to about 4,000 where we're super comfortable with that data set. Mm-hmm. Don't know whether we cut you and your coach out
of that or not. We didn't put any like evidence that we were that of who we were.
So, right. So oh, okay.
Probably took us out.
Took you out. Yeah. But yeah, this was really interesting because, you know, on the one hand, it's a really difficult assignment because you're given 7 independent games. It's not like you're following player X the whole way through. But on the other hand, with a sample that big, you'd still think that you could do better than chance on average, or there will be certain types of people who do better than chance. And so the two main results are, first, we really suck at this. We all really suck at this. I think like the average is something like 53 or 54%, where 50% is, you know, flipping a coin.
Yeah.
The second thing is that experience matters a lot. So the more years you've played chess, the better you are at detecting this. Mm-hmm. And that's correlated with rating. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the two, rating versus experience, experience is kind of the dominant factor.
So that kind of answers your question, yeah. As a strong player, you probably have a likely, high likelihood to...
But it was around 53%.
I think ones with 10 plus years of experience got up to like 58%, 59%.
Still not very accurate.
Still not as good as the players in the tournament. So the players in the tournament had that feeling during the game, which I think helped a fair bit. And they also spent more time on the task. Whereas on the online one, I don't know how long you spent, but most people spend an average of about 2 minutes per game. The ones who spent more, the ones who spent like 5+ minutes per game, they did better as well. Yeah. So it kind of says the more experience you've got in chess and the more time you spend on the task, the better you can do. But I don't know if that's what people do in the real
world. I think we took about 20 minutes total and we were just kind of discussing like the number of times and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did feel like it was difficult to get a grasp without actually being involved in the game.
Mm.
Like it's really difficult to judge from the side.
Yeah.
And that's why I when I see a game, like let's say in Title Tuesday, and maybe my feeling is it's really suspicious because someone is playing a lot of engine moves, right?
Yeah.
But I do feel like I have just a stronger like feeling during the game, but sometimes the feeling also betrays me. Like I feel like my opponent is maybe cheating early on in the game, and then some bullshit happens later, and maybe I win the game, or we just start making massive mutual blunders. And
right.
I'm like, okay, there's no way this was a game. But I had the feeling. I'm like, well, maybe my feeling doesn't count for much if it didn't predict what would happen for the rest of the game.
That's quite interesting because imagine you got to a point where, you know, you're losing now. And you had that feeling and you decided just to resign rather than play on, then you would have kept it, right? You would have kept the feeling saying, yeah, it's a cheater, because you wouldn't have been given that counter evidence at some point.
Yeah, I did try to change this like mentally that I don't give up because sometimes you get demoralized if you think you're facing someone who is cheating and they're beating you. But sometimes it does. I was kind of inspired by some players like Hikaru who they're playing someone who's like much weaker, outplaying them constantly. Maybe the player's cheating. But then somehow they trick them in time trouble. I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'm not as good as Hikaru at doing this, but if Hikaru can do it, then maybe I can also occasionally do it. And well, there's, I mean, they say never resign. There's no nothing to gain from that. But yeah, it is a very, I did take the test, and also our success rate was like 3 out of 7, I think.
Yeah.
So it wasn't very good at all. And I was trying to understand, like, is it because I have no grasp over what it looks like cheating or what doesn't, or was it because I'm not personally invested in the games? But I figured that if I'm getting a low accuracy, then probably overall people are not guessing too well.
I think it's just a very hard task. Like, I think it's much harder than people recognize. And there are a few players, very strong players, who overestimate their ability to a significant degree. So what you saw that also, we asked people their confidence that they had in their predictions. And you'd think that the more confident you are about it, the more likely you are to be correct. But that just doesn't hold. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who are just super overconfident, and that comes, unfortunately, with rating most of the time. Yeah. But it's interesting you said that during your games against people in Title Tuesday, you feel this sort of almost like helplessness. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing I can do here. It's a cheater. I also interviewed all the players at the end of this tournament, and that was one of the number one things that came out of it, this feeling of like hopelessness, inevitability. They got really depressed. But then when I asked them, okay, well, how did you feel when you were cheating? And the longer the tournament went on, the more depressed they got as well, because they realized that it affected their play in their non-cheating games.
When they're not cheating.
Yeah, they just didn't play as well anymore. And actually, I haven't analyzed this data yet, but during the games where they were waiting for moves, quite often they were playing poorly. So the increase in the quality of the games was coming from the cheating moves, but for the rest of the time they were just so distracted because they're just waiting, like, when's the move going to come, and also feeling a bit guilty.
That's very interesting, because you said that they didn't know when they will receive the moves.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of applies with the new delay that we see in most major tournaments, because let's say you have a 30-minute delay. If you have an earpiece and you're waiting for those 30 minutes to, like, develop, and then you, let's say, spend 20 minutes on a move, let's say it's a bad move, right?
Yeah.
But you still get some feedback later on in the process. It's a very interesting, let's say, finding that they play worse whenever they expect the moves, but they don't know when they're going to get it.
Yeah. This is the other thing that kind of shocked me, because I think most strong players have always assumed that you only need one or two moves to make a huge difference. You'll get 100 ELO points if you just get two suggestions per game.
That's basically what...
That's my feeling.
Yeah, feeling I think is. I've heard Vichy say that as well. Mm-hmm. I've heard you say it before. Yeah. And I also believe it to some extent, but that's a ceteris paribus thing we say in economics. So that's, if everything else is the same, that's what it means basically, then this will happen. Mm-hmm. The problem is that in a game where you know that you're getting moves, not everything's the same, because you're not playing your usual strengths. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know, maybe cheaters get better at it over time, but I think still it's very, very difficult to play at your true level knowing that you're cheating and knowing that these moves are coming at some point.
Did the players know their opponent's rating in this one?
Or they were given a 100-point bin. So okay. It was like they're somewhere between 1650 and 1750 or something like
that. Because you said that. Yeah. Some of them were like 1600s, some of them were like 2300s. Mm. That's a huge gap,
yeah.
Right? Was it more prevalent, let's say, in a game between a 2300 and an 1800, and the 1800 defeats the 2300? Mm. Did it happen?
It did happen, yeah.
And whenever you see those type of like differences, the higher rated player, is it more likely to accuse the other of cheating?
I thought that would happen, but actually there was no effect. So yeah. Rating seems to not play a role in it at all. I don't know why that is. I know that the very top player, the IM, got more and more depressed as the tournament went on, really didn't enjoy it too much. And there was one game where he was the cheater, and I decided beforehand he was only going to get two suggestions, because I was randomly doing, you know, how many suggestions you get, he was only getting two. I gave him two at what I thought were two critical moments, but it turned out that the game got more and more complex after that. Mm-hmm. He was just spending lots of time waiting for suggestions. They weren't coming. He fell to pieces. And that was, so he lost the game
so
as a cheater.
So he lost that game.
Yeah.
When he was a cheater.
Yeah. Fortunately, the opponent didn't accuse him, because that would have been a double whammy as well. I think the opponent was like, yeah, he can't be cheating in this one. But no, in the end, the rating didn't seem to matter. I mean, like, so 1600 to 2350, you know, is it only a small snapshot of the whole range of chess players. So it might have been different if I had, you know, a thousands up to 2600 or something.
Is it possible that because players knew that there was potential of cheating, and usually players don't think too much about it in most tournaments, that it could have created an unnatural atmosphere and affected in a negative way the player's normal play?
Could have done, and yeah.
Is it possible to, like, recreate the experiment where you have a group of cheaters who know that they're going to cheat, and a group of players who aren't going to cheat and don't know that anyone else will cheat?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think that's a really smart suggestion. So the actual main academic point behind this was just to get those 112 games so I could use it in the big survey. So that was priority number one. But the experiment was so cool to do that I would like to do it, you know, in a bigger tournament, sort of get 50 players, 100 players, and have a little bit of deception. And deception is kind of one of those weird things in academic domains because of the ethics around it. Because, you know, if I bring some people into play and I say, hey, it's a normal tournament, but actually there's cheaters, it's not clear whether that's ethical to them or not. But
have you pitched this to chess.com? Let's say do cheating Tuesdays, where everybody knows somebody will be cheating every single round.
Well, what Fabi's saying is that they can't advertise it to everyone. So some of the top players, they'll send it and say that it's a real Tuesday. And then the question is, you know, how would those players feel afterwards, sort of getting duped? I'd have to run that by Eric and Danny to see what he thinks. They're very open to the idea of gathering evidence, which I think is a really good thing. But I would be very keen to see that, because you're absolutely right. That is a potential concern, that even though I tried to make it as close as possible to the real world, if you know there's a chance of there being a cheater, it's a little bit different to a tournament where, in theory, you also know there's a chance, but you don't really think about it.
So there's not a certainty.
Exactly. Yeah. So in this, you knew, well, you didn't actually know there was a chance. In theory, there was a chance that you never faced the cheater. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I just told you beforehand, some of your opponents may be cheaters, yeah, might affect things. Yeah.
And this was online. Do you think it could be done over the board?
Yeah.
Tournament like this over the board. Yeah. I think that would be cool.
Halloween costumes for everyone. Well.
Sure. Yeah.
Why not? No, you want to see
people,
the faces.
People would know that. Yeah. People would know that this is a cheating tournament, let's say. And then
I think
basically
so.
The same thing, but over the board.
Yeah.
And then you see them. Maybe you can even include, I'm going to give you the moves, but I'm going to give it to you at the bathroom, for example.
Mm.
So,
but that
you're adding another layer to
it. But it has an element where there's a tell.
But everybody goes to the bathroom. Like, you wouldn't know who's going more.
Yeah, but you know, the spy equipment these days is so good that we could be sitting right now and I could be, all the answers that I could be saying, you know, I could my answers would be better in that case, but still, you know, I could have been getting these. So that would be possible. Actually, one thing I did in the survey, this is more of an academic-y sort of thing, but not everybody saw the same survey. I had tiny tweaks to the instructions. Mm-hmm. And one of the tweaks was that half the people saw this was a tournament and it was implied that it was over the board. The other half saw it and it was explicitly said it was online. And I thought that more people would level accusations or say, yes, cheater, if they thought it was online.
Mm-hmm.
No difference.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, which is interesting. It's a...
So there's an interesting distinction, because we have, as we mentioned, these two different domains, and generally speaking, people assume that most of the cheating is done online, and maybe people overestimate the amount of cheating that's online. But is it also possible that we both overestimate online cheating but underestimate over-the-board cheating, because we assume there's nothing nefarious going on when we can actually see our opponent?
Yeah, it's entirely possible. Yeah, and that's something that I can't test. So this is, you know, just my subjective opinion. But I also think that OTB cheating is kind of a potentially bigger problem, not in terms of the numbers, but in terms of the severity, basically. Right. Yeah. And for that reason, because I know that, you know, Chess.com's got this, really, they're really, really smart guys working as a team, but they don't look at OTB cheating really at all. The only time I think they did was the Neiman case. That was the only time. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's something that deserves a little bit more attention. And also that the behavioral type of intervention, like how can we sort of encourage kids to not go down that sort of slope? That's something I'm working on a bit with chess.com. I think that's, you know, it's maybe not a big piece of the puzzle, but it's a little bit like, you know, COVID, for example. You've got all these different types of angles and you're never going to get rid of it, but you have to sort of learn to minimize it. And if there are bigger sort of events, like you put in harsher measures, but you also need some sort of societal change as well. So, yeah, that's basically where I'm coming from.
In your paper, you also talk about the factors affecting suspicion. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The main one by far is just your own play. Mm-hmm. That was really sort of the main thing from that. And also the absence
of...
Your own blunders. Yeah. And like Fabi said, there are, you know, potential reasons for that are rational. There are also hypotheses that it's not rational. It's you sort of trying to externalize the blame. And I think that's something I'd like to explore in future, trying to really, because I didn't expect to find this at all. And now that I have found it, trying to work out the mechanism is the next step. So I would try to design some sort of experiment where we can see whether or not it really is people externalizing their own faults. And if so, I think that's kind of a powerful finding to spread as part of this behavioral message. Like, if you're really suspicious, you know, you may be right. You know, in Fabi's case, he might just have a good feel for it. But just be aware that there is this bias that we've found, you know, check it if you can. Yeah.
Do you think that people with that bias would be receptive to, like, if you presented evidence that they are biased in that way? Do you think they would be receptive to it?
So not everyone. I think there are some who will always believe that their intuition tops everything and will always sort of discount this sort of research. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a minority. I think in general, same with cheating, I think there are some people who always cheat, but the vast majority are kind of like, swing voters, you know, swing voters in cheating, swing voters in terms of evidence. So I think with evidence, they can change their minds.
Yeah, there's like a lot of, I think, uncertainty with it all. From my discussions with people, it's like very much, yeah, I think this, but maybe not. Mm. They might change their mind if they see some other evidence.
Yeah.
Actually, I want to ask, because you're kind of tackling these topics that are quite controversial, like you mentioned masks and gender, things related to gender in general and cheating, of course. Is there a time where you're looking at it from a mathematical perspective, but it's very difficult to break through either like ideological bias or just general bias that people have?
To break through my bias as a researcher?
To break through other people's bias. Like you present evidence, but it's very difficult to convince people with the evidence that you have.
I mean, so this is a challenge I face in all of my work. And so my major research project is not at all about chess. It's female genital mutilation or female genital cutting. I don't know if you know this sort of tradition that goes on.
In India?
Mainly in Africa, actually. Africa. Yeah. And it's related to other things to do with child marriage and a few other things like this. So that's actually my main project. Super tough, you know, super dark sort of project to work on day in, day out, which I try to approach from a mathematical evidence-based thing. And we actually, you know, we ran a big program in Somalia, which had very positive effects. So about 40% of the girls who received our program were never mutilated. So, you know, huge effects, huge improvement in lives. But getting that rolled out across the country was incredibly difficult because there's always going to be people in positions of power who say, yeah, okay, you've got this data, but it's our tradition or it's our way or it's, you know, and I'm some white guy from Australia coming into something that's ostensibly an African women's issue, you know, so it's very hard for me to have any sort of clout there. So that for me is a bigger challenge. In the chess world, I find that people are actually pretty receptive to data. Like you're receptive to it, FIDE's receptive to it, chess.com's receptive to it. There are going to be isolated individuals, some of whom have very large voices on social media or otherwise, who may not be. But I think for the most part, people are willing to take this on board. And people in positions of power or influence, like chess.com, are willing to take it on board. So I think, in a way, my chess research is a little bit easier to get across the line.
I feel it's because it's also something somewhat new. And we only recently, more or less, started discussing it quite at length, right?
Cheating.
Cheating. Yeah. Especially since like 2020, with online chess. I feel like it was an explosion, more or less. And now, as you were just mentioning, I think OTB cheating is starting to make its way into the discussion, more or less. And you see, you know, some top players, let's say, accusing or being suspicious of players. And now you have the cheating cases that are happening. So yeah, it's an evolving, let's say, subject.
I also think that chess players are wired a little bit differently, even from the average member of the public, because, you know, if you were brought up thinking that some line of the Nadov was playable for 20 years, and then new people come along with neural networks and just refute it, you're not going to say, oh yeah, I don't believe it, right? This has always been our way, because you're just going to lose, right? Yeah. So we're kind of wired that when new evidence... Exactly. Yeah. And when evidence comes, we change our minds. And I think that there is some sort of flow over of that philosophical makeup into other domains as well, for most chess players, I would say.
Yeah, I bet some stubborn chess players. But like usually people eventually, we're talking about openings, trying to convince that your idea is correct. And we do, okay, now with engines it's a bit easier, you can't really argue with the engine.
Mm.
But definitely there was a lot of back and forth during earlier analysis times. And yeah, usually people can really stick to their ideas very closely.
Mm.
But yeah, there is that flexibility. Like eventually if you are convincing enough, if you have a compelling argument, then chess players do sometimes amend their views.
I think so. I think the new generation in particular, the younger generation. With gender, it's a little bit trickier because, like I said, most of the voices, you know, particularly women's voices, it's impossible to detach yourself from your own lived experience. So they're always going to think, whenever they're told, you know, what do you think about this new policy? It's very natural to say, well, would that have worked for me? Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what we all do. But I don't think it's enough evidence to make something, you know, make a new policy that's going to affect hundreds of thousands of girls.
Yeah. David, I think, well, We have plenty to talk about, but we also are a bit restrained by time. There's a closing ceremony coming along.
That's right.
For your champs, and then you're going to present in the next couple of days. Thank you very much for joining us. Anything else you would like to add? Anything, any sort of pitch about your any of your new experiments?
I'm not so big on self-promotion, but I'd say, because I don't know how often you're allowed to say this on your own podcast, but you guys are doing a real service to chess with this podcast. I listen to it every week on the bike. I've got it in the headphones. So yeah, keep it up.
Thanks very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks
for being on. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks. Awesome.
Thank you.